You're listening to A Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott alongside Dennis O'Hara. President Obama last week visited the headquarters of Nike in Oregon to raise support for that Trans-Pacific Partnership, Dennis, also known as TPP. Now, it's a trade agreement under negotiation among 11 countries, including the U.S., Japan, and Mexico. And here's what President Obama said last week.
If I didn't think that this was the right thing to do for working families, I would not be fighting for it. If any agreement undercuts working families, I won't sign it. I ran for office to expand opportunity for everybody.
And Dennis, this week the Senate will vote on a bill that would grant the president the right to speed up the negotiating process. But groups in both parties, well, they are skeptical of this, of the TPP benefits, and including a very vocal Elizabeth Warren. You've been reading the back and forth between those two. Has been
the president in an interview on Yahoo said she's just wrong.
Yeah, when the president said you're just not right, you're wrong. But in the meantime, workers and businesses in Georgia are calculating how this TPP Accord might affect them. Well, joining us now to straighten all this out and ask questions as the first one, which is, what is it, is David Bruce. He's a professor of international business at Georgia State University. Professor Bruce, thanks for taking the time.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Let's set the table here because there could be someone listening. Their first question is, what is the TPP and why are people on opposite sides of this? So what is it?
Well, we've been having an increase of trade negotiations back to the early 1990s with the first one we had with Canada. We had a couple other bilateral ones with just individual countries like Israel and Jordan. But now, clearly larger economic blocks can be more competitive for the companies. They have several countries with less barriers. I think the fascinating thing about this one is, two aspects. Number one is China has not participated. Mm-hmm. So is it about competing with China or not? This isn't clear. Finally, they got Japan to join. And of course, Japan has had a lot of areas of indirect protectionism. And so Americans are interested in better opportunities into the Japanese market. But the other thing is, back in the early 90s, we were negotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement under a Republican administration, the first President Bush. But by the time it came up for ratification, Bill Clinton was the president, and the Democrats controlled Congress. And in fact, you need to remember this is different than a military treaty, which has to be ratified by the Senate. Trade treaties have to be ratified by both the House and the Senate. So you have all those different interests of every Congress member of Congress with a different district, might be agricultural, might be urban, and that really makes a difference. This is the first time now since NAFTA that we've been the other way around. It's under a Democrat that we're negotiating a free trade agreement, and it's the Republicans that control the Congress. But the problem is likely to be the same for the Democrats, which is to say large segments of the party, especially labor unions and environmental groups, have been very critical of these kinds of agreements from the beginning.
And in this agreement also, President Obama would sort of have the lead authority on this. Now, the Congress could come in and take some action as well, but just to sort of put this in, so I can put it in layman's terms, this is nothing new in terms of deals like this, but for someone out there to say, well, okay, but how does this impact me, a resident of Georgia?
Well, you know, Georgia's in a unique position because we're not a major manufacturing center here. Georgia is a service and distribution center. Mm-hmm. So in some respects, you know, politicians generally don't like to talk about imports. They get accused of, competing with local companies. But for Georgia, imports are kind of like a mini investment. We like a big investment coming in here, like, say, the Kia auto plant. And the reason that's why imports are like an investment for Georgia is you got to use our port, you use our airport, our railroads, our trucks, our warehouses, and then, of course, our lawyers, accountants. And so it doesn't make any difference so much for the Georgia economy generally what direction trade is going in. More is better than less.
You just hit where I was going, because the first question that occurred to me when I saw this was the port. And certainly Hartsfield-Jackson as well, because cargo moves through here so much. But the port is going to be, and especially once it's deepened, it's going to be an enormous, it's going to have an enormous impact here. So in terms of how Georgia political folks and economic folks view this, is that really the driver here for them?
Well, I think it's a major one. But I say also all the other people in the service business, all the way down to real estate agents that rent things to executives and so forth. And of course, a lot of people have said, well, if we have more trade with Asia, doesn't that mean it all comes through Los Angeles or San Francisco or Seattle? And the fact is, with the widening of the Panama Canal, bigger ships are going to come. And it turns out that putting something on a ship is more cost effective. The further you can go on the ship, the cheaper it is, relatively speaking. And so those ships are still going to be, and now bigger ones, coming through the Panama Canal. We're trying to attract them to East Coast ports, in our case, Savannah. If you get the goods in Los Angeles, first, they just had a strike. This is one thing. You can have disruptions. But secondly, you got to put everything on a train, put it on a truck, and ship it halfway across the country. And so there's a lot to be said in terms of lower costs of convincing producers in Asia to use the East Coast ports, which are, of course, closer to the majority of the American population that's east of the Mississippi River.
Yeah. So on the other hand, though, certainly the argument can be made, look, this will ultimately cost jobs in areas where we're trying to either restart industries or come up with new models for industries and get certainly manufacturing sector employees back to work in new types of jobs. This is just going to slow this down because it allows foreign competition to move into places where we're trying to get those jobs going.
You know, the key thing is it's very difficult to evaluate the impact because, first of all, trade and investment have been continuing to grow rapidly for the last 50 years. So if something like NAFTA goes into effect and then there's more trade, you say, well, what would there have been without it? It's hard to say. One thing is clear. If you go back and look at the critics of NAFTA, the ones who said it was going to be a disaster say the same thing today, and the ones who say it'd be a great success say it is.
So is there any objective way to measure?
Well, I think the key thing is because we have distribution and service industries, we will benefit. Clearly, there's going to be losers. You can't talk about free trade without saying somebody loses. That's the whole point. You shouldn't do things you're less efficient at. The big challenge is that those who lose the jobs aren't usually the ones that gain the new ones.
We're speaking with David Bruce. He's a professor of international business at Georgia State University, and we're talking about the TPP. Now, let me ask you this, because you mentioned winners and losers. Well, and this is sort of back to what I think Elizabeth Warren was saying. Well, look, won't the rich just get richer, and this would only benefit the corporations and the rich? And then once again, it's sort of you trickle down to the common man that we're sort of going to be the losers here.
Well, it is certainly connected to our challenges of education and our lack of competitiveness, not only in the sciences, but just general qualities. Because, for example, obviously we've been stronger in services and high tech, but it's a lot easier to, you know, if you're an auto worker in Detroit and you're 58 years old, to say to your son or daughter, I think you ought to try computer programming, than to say to that worker, it's time for you for your latter career to shift. So we know that you have to have some kind of transition for the older folks. There's no question about that. But the future jobs have to be associated with the information age and higher education.
You mentioned the automotive industry, and I want to get to that because I'm curious as to, are there particular industries that this probably would benefit more than, let's say, other sectors? And I think that's also a big argument that people are saying this is good for maybe, you know, for example, will farmers and the agricultural industry, could they benefit from this?
Mm. Well, of course, so many of our areas of agriculture are much more efficient than other parts of the world because of our soil, because of our technology, and so forth. And so farmers are protected by politicians practically everywhere. You know, it's kind of a gut thing of people. We don't want to be dependent on importing our food. Japan is the ultimate case because it was an island. It was embargoed in the 1930s. But the point is that with reduced reductions, our farmers are often, you know, quite competitive. Now, the flip side of that, for example, Wipro, which is kind of the Microsoft of India, has an office just a few blocks from us right here in Buckhead. That's where they're doing their mobile device software development. And they're doing it mainly with Georgia Tech and Georgia State grads. They didn't come to Georgia for cheap labor like we try to get programmers in India. They came here to get qualified labor and to be close to the consumers, who are, in fact, still the, you know, twice as big as the second economy in the world.
In terms of politics, and you're a political scientist, is the momentum and are the economic arguments such that there's almost no choice here but to ratify something?
Well, I'm not sure. Of course, we have an added tension to this right now that we're now in a presidential cycle. Mm-hmm. And so depending on where some of the Republican candidates are from, you know, they may have these kinds of issues. Part of the country they're from. For example, with CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, most of the Georgia delegation supported CAFTA. Most, if not all, of the North Carolina one didn't, in two states that are fairly similar. The difference is we don't have apparel anymore here in Georgia. We make carpet with high-tech technology, with chemistry, with engineering, but they still had apparel operations in North Carolina. So for the Georgia people, shifting the apparel work to Honduras instead of China or Indonesia meant it was easier to manage close by. We sell them the equipment and the technology, and because otherwise the Japanese or the Koreans will be selling it to the Indonesians.
But North Carolina was losing the textile manufacturing jobs.
So ideologically, you could be the most free trade congressperson from North Carolina, but you're awful hesitant to vote for these things if you want to get reelected.
Professor, I want to talk about labor because unlike some areas around the globe, I mean, the United States obviously has some very stiff and regulations as it relates to labor, but not all countries and areas are the same. But with respect to labor issues, does this agreement also call for some provisions to make sure that workers are treated fairly and treated in a humane way as well? Because we could go on and on about, and there's a trafficking summit here, although it's focusing on sex trafficking, but labor trafficking and issues with labor, that's a big issue right now.
No, it is. And as I mentioned before, the NAFTA one in North America Free Trade Agreement did not include those. And President Clinton did side agreements with the Mexicans and the Canadians to get the people in his party, the Democratic Party, to support NAFTA. Ever since then, these negotiations have had these topics on the table. Nobody said that that's a different issue the way they did during NAFTA. Now, the question is that enough?
Right.
But clearly, the Obama administration is going to argue to its critics that now we're pushing these points. And without the Pacific Agreement, we won't have that leverage over improved labor conditions in other countries.
And that's the question. Suppose this is not ratified. What would be the downside to saying, look, we're going to take a pass on this?
I'm not sure. I think I lean toward the argument that less barriers means opportunities in the long run. But for example, after NAFTA, we eventually pushed the idea of the free trade area of the Americas from the Bering Straits to Tierra del Fuego, all the countries except Cuba at that time. People here in Atlanta said we ought to have the headquarters of this organization if it takes place. It didn't get signed. But in the meantime, we continued to have having bilateral agreements with Colombia, with Peru, to Panama, because the countries on the Atlantic coast that traded more with Europe, for example, like Brazil and Argentina, weren't sure about free trade area of the Americas. But now those countries in South America are seeing us negotiating with the EU and negotiating with the Pacific, and they could get left out. I mean, I think the technology is such these days that you're going to have more and more trade, whether you like it or not. The trade agreements come after there's a lot of trade and kind of give a system and a structure to it that you can count on for adjudication.
And real quickly, Professor Bruce, when you look at, for example, on the continent of Africa and how many of those countries would rely on something like this, it would be, we've been hearing for decades that there's not enough investment in Africa. So an agreement like this would probably be very beneficial of all these countries and regions, but to the continent of Africa, this would probably be huge for them if this were to go through.
Well, yeah, there's the possibility that some could argue, well, we get cut out because some Southeast Asian countries have some of the same characteristics or qualities that we do. On the other hand, everybody realizes that the long-term growth next cycle is going to be in Africa. Right now, some of the African countries have special access to the European Union as former colonies, right? The British colonies, the British argue that their products ought to come in, the French and so forth.
But they're only getting a slice of the pie there. They're not, well, one would argue they're not getting what's fully deserved.
No, they're not. But, you know, for example, you may have heard of the General System of Trade, the GSP, of preferences. Well, many American companies support the general preferences, which are for poorer countries, giving special access to the U.S. market, because they count on those lower cost inputs to improve their products. So some of the people lobbying to keep preferences for countries in Africa are, in fact, American companies that have a lot of lobbying clout in Washington.
Gets really complicated politically and economically when you start talking about international trade agreements, and we're certainly going to see that in Congress over the next few days. Professor David Bruce is a professor of international business at Georgia State University. We'll watch it closely. We'll check back in with you.
Thanks
Thank
for
you
having
so
me,
much.
Sir.
Thank you.